From the studios in the Communication Arts and Sciences Building on the campus of Michigan State University, this is MSU Today. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus by Russ White.
At 6 past the hour, I'll get a summer update from Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon on all things MSU. We'll revisit my 2008 conversation with the late Ron Mason and meet the new leader of the Michigan Humanities Council.
The work that we do is all over the state, happening every single day. If you looked at a map and put a finger anywhere in Michigan, upper or lower, you could literally put your hand on a project that the Humanities Council has touched.
MSU Today begins at 4:06.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. As always, privileged to be back in the company of Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon for our summertime update, this time on all things MSU. President Simon, always appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much, Russ, and we appreciate the way in which you and your colleagues are able to communicate about Michigan State.
Well, thank you. We try to do our best. A lot on Detroit in this update that we're going to get to, but there's just a couple of big issues in the news that we wanted to get you to reflect on. First, the tragedy in Orlando.
Well, I'm always shocked by senseless violence that is rooted in hatred. And I know that it ripples not simply in the Orlando community and those who are directly touched because of the violence and hatred, but also to our own LGBTQAI community, because they feel that hatred could spring up anywhere. So it really means that we have to redouble our efforts to try to make sure that we our society that is respectful of various points of views and lifestyles, and at the same time remember that all people who are part of our community are Spartans.
And President Simon, as we're meeting, news has broken that Ron Mason, university icon and hockey coach, has passed away. To your thoughts on Ron?
Well, Ron not only was the winningest hockey coach when he left coaching, now it's been eclipsed by those who coached a bit longer, but also took up a role as university leader for the athletic department at a really critical time. And we know that our hearts and our prayers go out to the Mason family. Roy's already talked to Cindy this morning to offer our personal condolences. But these are ends of eras in many ways for not only a family but a university. And I think we need to pause and reflect that it's not simply about a win or a loss, but it's about the contributions that people like Ron Mason made to all those young men who were part of the program, but all those people who were part of hockey. I mean, he was always watching hockey games of little tykes as well as people who were, you know, moving on in the Muskegon team or this team or that team. And he kept in touch with his players as they moved beyond playing into other endeavors in their lives. And that's really what you want of an individual, not simply somebody who's good with where the puck should be, but somebody who's really good with people. And it came as a shock to all of us because he was, you know, very, very active. But it's a good lesson as well that people need to be attentive to their own health and take care of themselves, because that way you take care of others.
Catching up with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon on MSU Today. President Simon, at the recent Mackinac Policy Conference, you and your fellow University Research Corridor presidents released some data showing the UR institution's impact on Michigan's economy. A lot of data there and a lot of information that people can find, but a couple of key takeaways you'd like people to remember from this year's report.
Well, I think that the URC was often viewed as a political statement, not a genuine collaboration. And it is a political statement to the extent it's our role, our responsibility to show people around the country, around the world, that the intellectual assets, the intellectual infrastructure represented often by things like the Research Triangle or the institutions in Boston or Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Austin, where folks are using those as magnets for economic development, that's right here in Michigan, represented by those three universities. And we've been persistent in our benchmarking about how we rank, and we're ranked very high in the production of STEM graduates. We rank lower compared to the benchmark areas on entrepreneurship, and we're working on that. We're getting better, but others are getting better too, and so the ranking hasn't much changed. Then in addition to that, annually we've done sector reports, water, life sciences, automobile over periods of time. And this year it was on Detroit. And part of that was benchmarking our economic contribution to Detroit with Wayne State as the anchor institution in that community, but others being very actively engaged. And quite frankly, the research number was about the same as we did for water. So I was a little surprised at that number. I think that everybody's making an effort to purchase through Detroit, purchase locally, in ways that help to build the economy. And then there are just a lot of projects, almost 400 projects that are underway, along with, the sustaining elements of MSU extension being there. And so it's really a packed room. An impactful report, but one that I think will be a benchmark when we do it 10 years from now to chronicle our role in the resurgence of Detroit, which is good for all of us.
And President Simon, you served on an interesting panel with a futurist named Brian David Johnson. I thought there were some interesting topics you two exchanged. Again, people can watch these online at the Detroit Chamber site, but what struck you about your chat with Brian?
Well, I mean, I think we all have to be futurists in our own way. And we had a chance to talk privately as well as on stage. I think what he was trying to say is that he got his start, I think, as a futurist by trying to design a chip that would be the chip for 10 years from now as opposed to tweaking the chip for today. And I think that sort of mindset about how you really work at actively designing a future, not simply by waiting for it to happen to you, is one of the messages out of that set of comments. I'm not sure it was as clear as it could have been in the Q&A, but one of the messages that I took away, because oftentimes when you think about the future, you put a bunch of factors on and everything is being done to you, not what you can do to help shape that. And I think universities in their own way are very actively engaged in creating tools, ideas, solutions that can be used for the future and help to shape that future. The second thing about the message is that, technology is here to stay, as our technology-assisted parts of our life, whether they're robots or bots or Watson answering questions. And that I was really struck by his answer on the question of liberal arts. And he would tell you that everybody needs to learn how to code. And we've been saying that actually for a while. Your sons are in engineering. They got that message right away that no matter what field of engineering they're in, they need to learn how to code. Business students are getting that message. Liberal arts students should do that as well because, as he said, it takes liberal arts students to make sure the robot acts in an ethical and appropriate fashion, not just that it acts. And that's really going to be the future of robots in our lives. They can't take over because they can only approximate things human. And we have to take responsibility for them. They don't figure out things on their own, but we can put parameters on them, and that's why the coding piece becomes so important.
And the other thing I think that we talked a bit about was, you know, how you think about what all of us need to do in terms of futurists. And it's sort of use my golf analogy up there, which is my new analogy. You have to sort of, you know, I talk about seeing around the corner in the language I've used very often in the leadership pieces. But there's still a tendency to want to see around the corner and then sort of go up to the corner and make a turn and get to it. And what you see with the walking the course backwards, I've used that. I've used reverse engineering as the phrase, so it's all the same concept, is that if you plan backwards from where you are instead of only looking forward, you might find a way to use the golf analogy, cut the dog leg a bit and not accrue a lot of risk because of talent and skill and because you have a sense about what it takes to be on the other side of that work, and not simply try to avoid the trees that are in front of you, because you could have a couple trees in front of you in the dog leg analogy, but it opens up to a bigger space right behind them. And other trees have only trees behind them or water. And you need to know that and think about it in a particular way. Never be perfect, and there are always going to be errors and mistakes, but that's true if you imagine a hole straight in front of you, but you still have trees and sand traps and water and other things in the way. It just feels more comfortable because you can see all of those things. And what we have to do is be able to work with the unknown in pretty dramatic fashion because of the pace of technology and the things around us. And also to do that because we have to conserve energy and resources. And that will require us to think about that future a little bit differently in order to be sure that there, in the case of Michigan State, there's great value. In the case of a chip maker, that they've done the appropriate research for those things they need to imagine here for the future.
And President Simon, our now internationally renowned Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, one of the heroes of the Flint water crisis, certainly did her part at Mackinac to keep that topic on the front burner, which, as you've said, we've been involved in Flint for a long time.
We have. I mean, Extension's been there for 100 years. They were there to respond by adjusting, you know, information about what to eat, how to cook it, what to do in ways to minimize the effect of lead. But they're there anyway because, you know, the plan was to think about them working together with the College of Human Medicine and the Mott chairs, as well as the people on the ground educating our students and our residents like Mona, to really pull that together in a dynamic way. And we knew that there would be really a huge blip in Flint just looking at the demographics, as well as the future. If you think about the future of Flint, they're not big developers to come in and help save some of those neighborhoods. Mott Foundation has done an extraordinary job, but they need jobs, they need better education, they need lots of things. And we have been working with the Mott Foundation. That's really why we did the Mott Fellows on health and health disparities in Flint. And they've proven to be invaluable as we've written grants to do things which are really critical. But Mona has been the person who is the face of moving on and turning and not seeing this as an engineering problem where we fix a pipe, but seeing it as an opportunity to fix a community. And also recognizing that it's not fixing the community by us fixing a pipe. It's really having the community very, very actively involved in helping shape those solutions, even though sometimes those aren't the ones that people from the outside want to hear. We have to both inform, but it's a land-grant role, inform with great research and great knowledge, make it accessible to people, work with people, and believe that they will make wise choices for their future, because everybody wants a better future. And I think part of Mona's piece there as well was really saying that this is a long-term issue. It's not going to be fixed tomorrow. Some things can be fixed, but we have to work on this and make Flint, in the ag sense, the demonstration project, because this is happening in communities around the country, not in the same way, but the basic elements are there, so that there, we can figure out what works, what doesn't, and what we can do together to make lives better.
Catching up with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon on MSU Today. And President Simon, before we leave the Mackinac Policy Conference, just your general reflections on it. Each one kind of has its own ebb and flow and kind of identity. What do you take away from this year?
Well, I think that we continue to be a state that can celebrate enormously our success and not get trapped in, you know, the fact that we still are struggling from the effects of the recession, of the changing nature of work, and the need for us to see these things, whether they're Detroit or K-12 education or things like Flint, as not simply their problem but our problem. And I think that came through more in the conference this year than in other years. I think this capacity to both celebrate progress and be doggedly determined that we've got lots of work yet to do together is beginning to emerge in that Congress. There was obviously a lot of frustration on the island because the Detroit public school issue had not been resolved. And so that frustration, I think, was very apparent in lots of quarters, because time does matter. I mean, if you think about Flint, time matters. Time matters. Being able to, I don't want to say, and being able to move on these issues one way or the other, you know, and get working on them is really critical. And so that frustration was obviously there, as it remains in Detroit, because the bill's a compromise. But we have to make compromises work, because we are an imperfect world. Even if people are working with the best of intentions, they have different points of view, and those compromises can be very difficult sometimes to deal with. But if we sort of define them only as wins and losses, you won, I lost, they won, we lost, but as a platform for trying to find a better tomorrow. I think that was a part of what Mona was trying to talk about in her TED talk, or her TED-like talk, I should say, or Mackinac moment. That's what I think, if you look at the URC report, over all the things we're doing in Detroit before it was fashionable to do them, you know, it came through there, and that you just got to move on and figure out this is a new base, and we got to still work because we need very well educated kids in our state. We need more college graduates in our state. We need the intellectual infrastructure. And the comment I made really there and at Detroit Economic Club is if we're not really careful, and Detroit represents an example of letting intellectual infrastructure decay. It's easy to see it when you have a pothole in your road, but we're also going to learn from Detroit that takes a while to get it back. And unlike a road where you can really fix it and it looks new, you know, how do you fix a child, you know, who has lost 5 years of reading and hope to get it back in, because it's neurodevelopment. We can work on it. Or how do you sort of, you know, fix a child that's, you know, like a road that's been exposed to all the factors, not just lead? And it means we have to work together and work diligently and put a lot more emphasis on intellectual infrastructure and community infrastructure, people infrastructure, not simply roads or bridges or, you know, fun for jobs. We got to worry about this holistically and make it our collective problem and challenge. But not so much a problem in that it's a deficit, but really an opportunity to move this state forward if we think about it that way.
But if we don't prioritize intellectual infrastructure, then it turns into a huge mess, and it takes a while to fix. And we can't afford that in a knowledge-based economy that's global and heating up. We can't. Any of us can't face that. And I worry that universities are doing okay now, so we're not the biggest pothole on the road or the bridge that will be judged as being okay and not subject to needing to have a fix. But that down the road, how do we know that without careful attention, you know, and really a sense that this is a common public good, that it will continue? And again, you can't fix it like a road or a set of pipes. And so, but it's easy when we don't want to spend money and things are okay to spend $45,000 for a prisoner and $6,000 for a student and wonder what happened.
Fascinating thoughts, President Simon. We recently announced also the MSU Detroit Center for Urban Food Systems, which will facilitate best practices for food and non-food plant production and a variety of related community support activities. I know we're early in the project, but what...
I'm not sure announced is the right word.
What about that project as we're early? Do you want people to know?
We've always done this. I mean, so this is really a consolidation of a set of initiatives that we're doing with a recognition that that consolidation is really important. Because if you look at the report, if you look at the map of what, you know, all those urban gardens, the work that Mike Hamm did in Metro Food Plus to get that set up, the question is how do you coalesce and focus some of those activities? And then the bigger question is, when we do that, can we help a neighborhood? And is there a leveraging factor, not simply as a demonstration project, but for a neighborhood? Do we have partners, both in the private sector and in the not-for-profit, in the community, who are willing to think about this in a particular way that helps us to consolidate some of our work so there's a one-stop shop to look at how to think about soil remediation, and there's a one-stop shop to think about the various aspects of the urban food system. So that you can not only have a person in an office, but you can see some things happening in new and different ways. And those ideas can be moved to other parts of the city because you have a bit of that land, much like if you go to a ag bio center in the Thumb, you'll have an aggregation of work that helps to be interdisciplinary, to move more rapidly because there's a community voice about it all. It's not just us across growers and processors and the economic aspects as well as the environmental aspects. And how does that move into, you know, food systems and advice about food systems right away? We do that in the Saginaw Thumb with sugar beets and dry beans. We do it in Traverse City regarding cherries and wine and other things. And we do it, you know, in Clarksville about apples. Right. You know, so these are not new things to us. So how do you think about the things that are best grown in urban settings in varieties of ways? What do we do about moving some of that together in a little bit larger scale? And how do we then tie that to the development of a neighborhood, a community? And we're looking for some land. We won't own the land because that really has to be of Detroit, but that it's ours to care for under our auspices. And that we try to put these packages together with local developers and with not-for-profits to see how that food system piece can move a neighborhood forward. And you know, we'll still be in the Eastern Market. We'll still be in all the other neighborhoods. So this isn't a consolidation. This is another way of thinking about using upsets of place to improve what we're doing.
And lastly, on Detroit President Simon, I understand there are quite a few exciting internships going on. We have more students than we have internships for, but a major effort there now.
Well, Detroit by the semester in Detroit, and we want to thank Dan Gilbert and actually Wayne State for housing students. Even the newly minted PhD faculty member running the program is living in the residence hall because housing is so hard to find in Detroit. But they're doing a variety of projects. That group is doing a variety of projects, including working with the Park Service, and they're doing their own projects. We want to thank, again, Rock Ventures, Dan, for Quicken Loan family of companies, right. I probably should say, for supporting that and helping us, and we intend to grow that. In addition, there are numbers of kids doing just basic internships in Detroit through a variety of companies, including Quicken, as well as not-for-profits. Two new twists to that for this year, since that number has been growing, as the report suggests, was to allocate some interns' work to work on the mayor's initiative about the employment of high school students this year. And we're really pleased to be a part of that. And secondly, working with Sue Mosley in Midtown. Most people would credit Sue Mosley with being that community partner, that visionary but tenacious community partner in the development of Midtown. And we're going to assign some interns directly to her. She has been part then of the idea about implementing the aspects of the Innovation Zone report that I was a part of a year ago, over the last year or so, that includes Corktown up through Midtown. And using those interns to help foster and sustain some of the efforts we need in the Innovation Zone. So that's really great. And over the summer, we'll also, I think, open the Composite Center in Corktown that sits next to the light metals work of University of Michigan. We're part of that, but they're more of a lead in that. We're the lead nationally. It's really neat that there were like 8 or 10 of these centers nationally. Two of them are in Michigan, one led by Michigan State, the other led by the University of Michigan. So that's really terrific, and both in Detroit.
President Simon, as we close, I'd just like to ask you what anything else you're kind of reflecting on this summer, or you want Spartans to maybe think about coming up in the fall, or what else are you pondering these days?
Well, I think we're always trying to think about ways that we can be better tomorrow than we are today, and I think you'll see some of those with the work of IPF in Baldrige, Alumni Association's done some strategic planning to try to better connect to young alums. We're going to sort of continue to work on finishing up the campaign and not simply finishing it in a numerical sense, but really building the basis for the next campaign. And so I think those are things that you'll see. You know, we continue to try to figure out how to improve the neighborhood concept. And I think we're neighborhood 3.0, where we are now. We've convened a group of our African partners to think not simply about what we're doing tomorrow, but what it looks like in the future, sort of Africa partnerships, you know, 2020 or 2025. And we've got some great ideas about that, so we feel really good about all that work. We've got new deans coming in a variety of places with great energy and enthusiasm and ways of moving not only, you know, for tomorrow, but down the road a bit in terms of that futuristic thinking. So we're really clear about that. We've got a plan about how to be the food university of the future, not just of today. And those are all really terrific ideas. And I'm going around telling everybody they need to learn how to be a coder. But it's not necessarily taking a class, but you can go online and learn a lot about coding. Not because you want to be a heads-down coder, but because you need to understand that as the language of the 21st century. Yeah. So you need this is not to say don't do foreign language, but everybody needs to have the language of the future, and that will be understanding coding in the sense of what it means. It's not really the old stuff that we would put under computer science, but it's something for the future. And so I'm telling folks to get their kids engaged in coding.
President Simon, thank you very much for again sharing your insights with us on MSU Today.
Well, thank you very much, Russ.
That's Michigan State University President Luanna K. Simon. Keep up with all her busy activities at president.msu.edu. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
AM 870 WKAR.
What do you say we try this Let's Go State thing again, all right, Spartan fans? Hit it!
Ron Mason, the second winningest coach in college hockey history and MSU's athletic director from 2002 to 2007, passed away last week. He was 76. I spoke with Ron in June of 2008 when he was getting ready to retire from MSU and turn over the reins of Spartan Athletics to Mark Hollis. Here's that conversation again.
It's an honor to have Ron Mason on MSU Today, who's retiring after an almost 30-year career at Michigan State University. Ron, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. You know, it seems like the time goes quickly. I remember when I came, Emil Bassoni had been here 28 years, and I said, how can anybody stay in one place for that long? Well, now I've passed him, so I guess it's a wonderful place to be.
Well, Ron, you did put in 29 years of service at MSU. You're the winningest coach in college hockey history with 924 wins, including the 1986 national championship. And, of course, you've served as athletics director at MSU since 2002. Just as you look back in general, how does it feel? You've been so busy your whole life, and now you're going to wind things down a bit. How does it feel?
Well, I haven't had a chance to think about it yet much. I've still been doing some things, and I'm starting to do things now that other people did for me. It seems like it takes up a lot of time. I have more respect for the people that were helping me out. But, you know, you look back on it, you come here as a very kind of a young coach with pretty good experience. And someone gave me the press clippings of my very first interview way back in 79. And it's just amazing as to what I said that day. I didn't plan anything, but what came out of my mouth has almost turned out to be true. And it kind of makes me wonder. I felt good about Michigan State. I really thought there was a great opportunity here, and obviously it turned out good.
From the coaching part of your career, just some highlights or special moments?
Well, it's easy to say. Maybe the most special was that very first day when Joe Kearney called me and said, we'd like to come to Michigan State. And I've never looked back from that. I would have liked to have won more national championships, that's for sure. I think we had teams to do it. Just didn't happen. Thank goodness we won one. But we put up a lot of different championships here, Russ, and I think that that's a credit to the stability we had with the number of players and assistant coaches we had. We hung a lot of banners. We were always in the thick of things. We did things right. That's always been something I've said, is to follow the rules, do things right. And as George Pirtles would say, good things will happen. And in my case, I want us to represent the university, the sport, their families, and our fans and donors in a positive way.
And, Ron, how did or has the game of college hockey changed in your mind over the years, if it has?
Well, the game has become better than it used to be. Just like the NHL, I think, is better now. It's a freer skating game, more scoring chances, not more goals, but scoring chances. But I think the one big change today is in the recruiting, where young people are committing to schools and schools are committing to them at a very young age. And I'm talking about grade 9, grade 10. To me, I don't think that's a very good trend. I think that I'd like to see people be a little bit more mature, make a decision a little bit later. I think it's best for both parties. The one thing that's changed so drastically, even in the last 5 or 6 years, is communication. You know, with one click of a button, you can get to 10,000 people. Or if you make one wrong statement, it's seen by many. No one has to address an envelope anymore, write a letter, sign it, and put a stamp on it. They just have to press a button. And I think that's taken away from some of the respect and some of the work that our people do. But it's an instant communications type of business today and world, and we just have to live in it.
What would you say then is sort of the state of college hockey in 2008? Is it healthy?
I think it's very good. All you have to do is look at our national championship, which is sold out every year no matter where we put it. This past year it was in Denver. It's going to be in Tampa. It's going to be in Washington. Obviously, it's going to be in Detroit and Ford Field. I think we've really got, on a national scale, a good job done by everybody to get it to that level. We still are a local sport. We will be a regional sport. The NHL is a regional sport. But where we play it and where people watch it, it's come along very nicely.
Talk a bit about then the transition from hockey coach to athletic director. How did that come about?
Well, that was a tough decision. I was thinking maybe I might stick around five more years and continue to coach. And I had the opportunity to be the AD more than once. And this time I felt it was my last chance, and I had to make a decision. It was a family decision. It wasn't just mine. And I think it was a good decision. At the time, I think Michigan State was looking for somebody like me, and I think it was a great transition for me. I think the hockey was wearing on me a lot. When you're in it for as many years as I was, all you really get excited about is winning a championship, and the rest of it doesn't seem to work. You always were happy with the players and how they developed, but it seemed to be championships what people wanted, and that was tough. But for the most part, it was a good move to become the AD, and it wasn't as difficult as I thought because there were really, really good people in place. I think that's the key to it's a people business, and if you have good players, you have good teams, and we had great players when I took over as AD.
Ron Mason, my guest on MSU Today. Ron, what about then highlights or memories from athletic director?
Well, I know when Clarence came in, we were in some turmoil, and Clarence did a nice job. Clarence Underwood did a nice job to kind of calm the waters and get people back doing the right thing, which made my job a lot easier. You know, you can look at bricks and mortar. Obviously, we're sitting here today in one, and now with the Duffy building being completed, the old college field, not a lot of nice things done there. That's easy to point to. But I guess maybe the one thing I feel proud of is, and I tried to get this across to everybody we hired and all the people within the department, is that whether we like it or not, we're all in it together for the good times and the bad times, if there are some. But we really want to follow the rules, whether they're institutional, NCAA, or individual conference rules. And try to keep ourselves out of the NCAA investigation time. We've seen it happen to some schools in the Big Ten, and it's dreadful. So we were able to remain, I think, solid, getting more respect through the NCAA and around the country. So I feel really proud about that.
Ron, athletics is such an important dimension of the entire Michigan State University brand. How has the marketing of that brand evolved in your years as AD?
Well, you know, I brought a winning athletic director into a chair, and of course our basketball program has really gone strong, both men's and women's really. And we have other programs that pop up now and again that really do a nice job, whether it's field hockey or crew, whether it be softball, whatever it might be. But, you know, the football program is one that I think is now headed definitely in the right direction. We went through some rough times, and we all know those. And I think some things were accomplished in those rough years to give Mark a better chance. And I hope that program will come along and represent it in the way everybody expects. And I'm pretty sure it will.
Ron, even though its distribution was limited in its first year, has the Big Ten Network had a positive impact on the awareness of the full athletic team portfolio at MSU? And will it get better?
Well, it's definitely going to get better. If you're a parent and you're not living in the general area and can see your son or daughter play, this is unbelievable. I can only refer to it from a hockey standpoint when our games would be on the CCHA Game of the Week. People in British Columbia or people in Western Canada in general or East Coast or Montreal could watch their kids play. That was a big thing. And you're going to be able to see more of that in the Big Ten Network. I know we went through some growing pains and people were upset with it all, but in the long run, it was a great decision by Jim Delaney, a great decision by the presidents to move forward with this. It's a financial gain for all of us. And in today's world, there aren't too many places you can turn to get a financial gain.
Ron, as we close, I mean, what are the key issues and challenges facing your successor, Mark Hollis, and really all of college athletics in the years ahead?
Well, with the cost of doing business, Russ, that's the biggest problem we have. I remember in 2002, I passed a gas station. I could have bought gas at 95 cents a gallon. Well, you know, we'll never see that again. And that quadruple cost alone is translated to a lot of the other things that we do. Being here in the state of Michigan, your corporate relationships, if you can maintain what you have, I think that that's very good. I think as well, we haven't raised ticket prices because we understand where we are within the economical piece. However, you still have to give your student athletes a quality experience. So there's a real fine line there. And I think our Ralph Young Fund and the work that they've been doing and developing some endowments and other aspects of that are critical to our success. And Mark is a marketing guy, so he's going to be able to build on that. I think he's going to build on our fundraising. Because without that and without our donors, we can't make it anymore.
Ron, just some closing thoughts or a message you'd like to leave Spartan fans around the world with?
Well, I think be a believer. I think that the bottom line is if you look at our department from top to bottom, just remember we are trying to do it right. We're trying to make them proud every time a team or any sport goes on the field or in the pool or on the water of some description, that they can be proud the way we're treating our student-athletes. Because when you come right down to it, Russ, that's what it's all about. How do you treat and give your student-athletes a quality experience both in the classroom and in their chosen field? So I think our people can be proud of that. And remember, it's very difficult to win every game. It's a very fine line. So we hope we can win more, but we're going to win away from the game too, and that's what's critical for most of these kids.
Ron, thanks for joining us, and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Ron Mason is retiring after 29 years of service for Michigan State University as the winningest college hockey coach in history and the last several years as athletic director. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today on Spartan Podcast.
AM 870 WKAR.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, as we've often emphasized on this program, social and cultural understanding and preservation are key components of community sustainability, every bit as important as the environmental and economic components. An organization committed to the cultural awareness and appreciation is the Michigan Humanities Council, and with us is Shelley Kasprisky, the new executive director of the Michigan Humanities Council. Shelley, great to meet you.
Thank you, Kurt. It's so nice to be here.
Now, you've been on the job for about 5 months here. Yes. Give our listeners a little snapshot of your background, and then tell us mission and vision of the Michigan Humanities Council.
Sure. Well, my career actually began in public health, but I got a phone call about an opportunity with the Michigan Humanities Council and decided to take a look at it. And what a wonderful career step that was for me.
Well, the Michigan Humanities Council, some of our listeners are going to be very familiar with the work that you do, some may not.
Yes. So the Humanities Council really has a mission of making sure that everyone has the opportunity to connect to one another through the humanities. So through civil discourse, through arts and culture, through historical projects, museums, libraries, literacy. It's really about the human ties, what makes us all connect together. And the council is funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as Makaka, and we do have private donors as well. We have an excellent partnership now with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, and the work that we do is all over the state, happening every single day. In fact, if you looked at a map and put a finger anywhere in Michigan, upper or lower, you could literally put your hand on a project that the Humanities Council has touched.
Well, you mentioned the Kellogg Foundation, and I know related to that, you just announced the recipients of your Heritage Awards. Tell us a little bit about that. A big program and frankly, quite a bit of money.
It is quite a bit of money. We recently awarded $650,000 to 28 projects around the state. And they all revolve around racial equity and recording the history of the cultural and ethnic experience as it relates to race. And I personally read every single grant application. I thought that would be a good learning experience. And it was amazing to see the stories that people wanted to tell and the ability to really get across cultural messages and ethnic and racial issues within communities. So it can be, some of our projects can be anything from the Yemeni population in Coldwater, which I never knew about, to projects in Southeast Michigan, Native American work in the UP. You name it, we provided funding to help that happen. And so it really focuses on oral histories and helping cultures understand one another. And I think that's really critical at this time as racial tensions seem to be rising.
We've done quite a bit of on social justice, environmental equity, environmental justice on this program. Very important to community sustainability, isn't it?
It really is. I think it's critical that we continue to have these conversations as challenging as they may be or as celebratory as they may be. Understanding one another's perspective, particularly with a historical context, is really critical to us being able to move ahead as a society.
My guest is Shelley Kaspersky. She is the new executive director of the Michigan Humanities Council. Shelley, you do a thing every year, and I've gone to a couple of sessions in the past. It's called the Michigan Read, the Great Michigan Read Program. You just concluded that. The novel this year was called Station 11, Emily St. John Mandel or Mandel. I know she was. That novel actually had some major environmental themes and subplots.
It really did. It was a fascinating novel. It really defied any particular genre. But the concept was, it was set in Michigan, and it was about a traveling theater troupe that that tries to continue to bring the humanities, essentially, around the state, but in the face of a horrible pandemic that wiped out society. And it was fascinating to read and to have to share with, you know, Michigan citizens in general. And we had anything from high school kids reading it right through, you know, the oldest populations. And everyone really bonded with that book.
Well, I noticed it was a National Book Award finalist. I mean, that's huge. And a Penn Faulkner Award finalist as well.
Yes.
I mean, this book has received, this novel, some major national recognition.
It did indeed, and we were so lucky to have Emily with us, in fact, for a number of stops. She was here all over Michigan. In fact, at one up north, she got snowed out, unfortunately. We flew her here, and then a storm hit late, and it kind of wiped out those visits. But we ended up over in Southeast Michigan with, for example, a venue at Plantera, which is just beautiful, and a Detroit Symphony Orchestra quartet.
Wow.
Performed music that explored different book passages. It was amazing.
Oh, that's fabulous. Mm-hmm. Well, I know you can't announce next year's yet, but we'll wait, and maybe when you do, we'll have you back on the program. Let's talk, we've got to talk about the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibition. I know you've done, the Michigan Humanities Council has done several of those, and I think there's one ongoing now, but you've got one coming up in 2018 that focuses on water.
We do. Currently, we're working with the installation of exhibits around the state on hometown teens, which explores the
sports teams.
Okay. It explores the effects of sports teams on communities and how that bonds people and the history. We have them at five different locations around the state this year. But we're preparing for the Waterways exhibit, which will be coming in 2018. That's just starting to travel around the nation now. And the idea is to explore the effect, history, context, social implications of water. And certainly here in Michigan, probably more than any other state, we know what that means. And not just referring to Flint, of course, but thinking about our Great Lakes and how we value and protect those assets and the infrastructure and water and what that all means here in Michigan.
Well, you know from your research and have people on your board, but the importance of water is growing almost daily, and the interface between water and energy. I mean, you couldn't have picked a better topic for 2018, and it's only going to get more significant as time goes by.
Yes, and we're really exploring the possibilities of doing more work in the environmental humanities. That's something our board is going to be discussing next week, and we're looking towards the future and what role the Humanities Council can play in supporting that work.
Now, that's a new term for me, environmental humanities. That's a very interesting concept. Is this something that's newly emerging, or has this been around for a while?
Well, one of the things I love about being a part of this council is that there's 53 other councils around the country. Some are doing some work in environmental humanities. So when I use that term, it can be providing funding for specific environmental projects that involve history and elements of humanities, or it could be having a speakers bureau that specifically addresses those kinds of topics. So it's really something we're exploring at this point, but I'd like for our council, and I know our board and staff does as well, to really be cutting edge and exploring
absolutely.
Where we can go.
We've had the good fortune of having a lot of great student interns on this program over the last 7 years, and we've just got a new wonderful student, Communications and Public Relations, Kathleen. But speaking of youth, you sponsor or are involved in a Michigan Youth Journalism Experience, the Pulitzer Prizes. All the applications are in. There are going to be some lucky students who are going to be able to do something, maybe attend a major conference in October. Tell us about it.
Yes, we have students who are participating in an NEH-funded Campfires Initiative, which is really all about storytelling. And part of that funding is through having the Pulitzer Prize competition, which just passed. But students were answering the question of what role journalism plays in a democratic society. We know how relevant that is now. And so these students, and I'm excited to read their essays, will be invited to a conference that will take place here at MSU's campus on October 23rd and 24th. And the winning students will have the opportunity to work with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. And what a treat that will be. What an honor.
What a fantastic experience that will be. Well, I wish we had more time, but we're going to definitely have you back, Shelley. I've been talking with Shelley Kasprzycki. She's the new executive director of the Michigan Humanities Council. Shelley, great having you on the program. Look forward to some future conversation as the months roll on.
Thank
Best of
you.
Luck to you.
It was my pleasure. Thanks okay. so much.
Was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.